Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. I'm host Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm co-host Natalie Lynch.
And there's a flagship episode coming out on Monday, but it seems as though the world is changing just a little too quickly to wait until then to get back on this thing, huh?
Yeah, so this is a 911 podcast.
So earlier this week, you were at work, which you mentioned recently is working on airplanes. What did you experience?
So I have been flying all over, basically from fire to frying pan.
New York. What do you mean by that?
New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Fort Lauderdale.
Yep, all the hot spots.
It's everyone is very nervous. You know, one woman got on the plane last night and she pulled me aside and she said, "If the gentleman who's three people behind us is sitting next to me, I'm not getting on this flight. He won't stop coughing." Mm. And so, you know, but you know what is also really cool?
What's that?
Is I feel like humanity's up right now.
Okay, that's
so good. You know, I'm seeing pictures of people working from home with their babies on their lap saying like, "Hired this little assistant today now that I'm working from home." And I just feel like there's this like slowdown and this cultural shift to like the essentials and to like what's health and family and...
Yeah. Hey, speaking of family, you got a message earlier from some family in Italy.
Yeah. So I have family who live in a rural town in Italy and they're on lockdown right now until April 3rd. So I got a message, you know, just reaching out saying like, "Hey, we're doing well. No one in the family has it, but we're not allowed to leave the house." And his dad's a butcher. So he's allowed to go. He has like a special certification to leave because it's food, pharmacy and hospital related.
Essential services.
Yeah. But he basically was like, "Yeah, it's a big deal. There's 5,000 respirators in the entire country. And because this is a respiratory illness, like that's a real shortage."
Yeah, I think they're already at over 16,000 diagnoses or something like that. Angela Merkel recently said she expects 2/3 of Germans to contract it. I heard Malcolm Gladwell yesterday talk about a WHO briefing where they said it's most likely going to affect 40 to 70% of Americans. So this thing is very real. The calls to wash your hands and keep your hands off your face. I think most people by now know this, but it's important to keep saying it because we got to do everything we can.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. So I have a friend who's visiting from high school and she works in public health in Ohio. And she was just saying that she was talking about men particularly when they go to the bathroom, not washing their hands because they don't believe going to the bathroom when they just have to urinate is going to the bathroom. Like a lot of men will say, come out and say,
"Is she doing like surveys on this?"
Yeah. She was saying that like a lot of gentlemen will say, "Oh, I just peed." I feel like, you know, I don't know.
I think right now leaving the bathroom for whatever reason you walked in there, mandatory hand washing. I don't care if you opened a window. I don't care if you grabbed one paper towel with two fingers. Mandatory 20 seconds of hand washing.
Yeah. Have you seen those videos too? Or not videos, pictures that show the zones of the hands that are like commonly missed?
No.
Or like...
The zones of the hands that are commonly missed. I mean, how pathetic are we? How pathetic. We need this.
The zones of the hands that are commonly missed, and then pictures of what it looks like if you've just washed with water versus washed with soap.
Okay.
Versus washed for 20 seconds.
Good.
Lyrics of songs that are 20 seconds
wonderful.
Long,
so you can make a game out of it. We have to gamify everything to do.
But and speaking of singing, there was a beautiful video on going around on Facebook this morning of an Italian village. Since everyone's locked in their homes, one gentleman started saying, it seemed like Les Mis.
Right. It's like proving that everyone in Italy actually does sing opera.
One gentleman started singing and the whole street started singing out their window. And it wasn't it sounded really good.
Yeah.
I mean, like it almost brought me to tears.
Check
it
out.
Really,
Italy
really
singing coronavirus. That ought to pull it up. All right. Thanks, Natalie. Let's stay safe. You and I got to be careful ourselves. Maybe got to do a little self-quarantining ourselves here. It's getting real.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of do that anyways sometimes.
That's true. At least
now we have a socially acceptable reason.
Yeah, a cultural mandate to stay home. Thanks, Nat.
All right.
I'm recording this just after 2:30 p.m. Eastern on Friday, March 13th, and I am joined by Drs. Mike and Amar from the Cheat Code Sickle Cell Podcast. Guys, how are you, and how are things in Detroit today?
Things are a little different in Detroit today, actually. We got notified last night by the governor that we're in state of emergency and schools are shut down for the next 3 weeks. Things are kind of unusual. How about you, Dr. Mike?
Yeah, I personally am doing well, but there is a lot of anxiety and changes around here. My five children are all now off of school for the next 3 weeks, so we're working on some logistics around that and trying to make plans for the hospital and the clinic and get information out to all of our warriors to make sure they're safe.
And what new information have you guys read or received, say, in the last 24 hours? Things are changing so quickly, but just in the last, say, 24 hours, that has you most concerned when you are thinking about your warriors in particular?
So I guess I'll kick that. I was going to say I can kick that off with some numbers. So as of last night at around midnight, the United States has almost just under 2,000 confirmed cases. 295 new cases in the last 24 hours and 41 deaths. So these are numbers that are very different than the last time we talked. These numbers seem to be climbing very quickly.
And I think too, you know, we had 3 cases in Michigan just a couple of days ago, and now we're up to 12. And you know, there's been a big national story about the testing. And sort of the limited availability of it. And so I think we don't have a great handle on how many people there are. There was a kind of, you know, frightening and probably fits into one of my pet peeves story out of Ohio, where the medical director thought maybe they have 100,000 cases. And I think one thing that I'm finding very frustrating is I found throughout this whole course of this disease, many people are saying things with the utmost confidence that have nothing to do with reality. So I think, you know, last week there were lots of people saying, well, you should be worried about the flu. You shouldn't be worried about this. Now those same people are, you know, really getting sky is falling about this. And I think the answer is, you know, we don't know. I think some of the information, even the most expert people are still trying to put together. So I think, you know, try to stay calm, try not to panic, take everything people say with a grain of salt.
I think that for me, just as you're saying that, Dr. Mike, that is the most frustrating part, is that there's so much unknown about how this thing is behaving. And, you know, even though we've done a pretty good job as a scientific community to piece some of that together, there's still a lot of unknown as far as what is it going to look like here in the United States a week from now? You know, that's still a big question mark.
And I've seen some things that I think make a lot of sense. You know, our schools are closed now. They've talked about social distancing. I think we're getting information from other countries that are doing that slows the spread down, and that seems quite reasonable to me. There's some information about... Go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's our experience right here in America from the Spanish flu, where shutting down schools and churches and libraries really changed the way different cities had sort of death happening in their own sort of towns. So we know it works.
And that was, telling me about a study. There was 2 cities, like New York, didn't shut things down, and St. Louis did.
Yeah, exactly. It was Philadelphia and St. Louis that they compared. Philadelphia sort of had this attitude, very Philadelphia attitude of like, tough city, we're good, we don't need to worry about anything. They held a parade, they didn't shut down schools, and they had a death rate that skyrocketed. St. Louis, about 9 days later, shuts down virtually the entire city and has a death rate that hardly made any difference really in that city. So it became clear that this is a methodology that works.
So social distancing works. What else are you telling patients and people who are seeking advice on what to do? What do you find is the number one message that you're communicating right now?
So I think people are getting inundated with information from lots of different sources. And I think most of it is the same sort of things to stay away from sick people. If you're sick, hunker down at home and don't spread to other people. If you start to develop respiratory symptoms, then you need to go see a medical professional. But for just a cold or a fever, you should probably stay home so that you don't come spread the germs even at the hospital. I think, you know, I'd, for our warriors, and I think for anybody with a significant illness that might put them at higher risk, I would say speak to your doctor specifically. So, you know, we're fielding some calls here about what to do. But I think for the most part, you know, very similar to what we talked about last week with hygiene, with staying away from sick people, with just common sense practices. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot more we can do. There is some promising information, I think, about some drug treatments. It's very early, but there are a repurposed HIV drug and a malaria drug and a antiviral drug that's actually in a phase 3 trial. That all sound like they are showing some promise there. So that's a little bit of hopeful news.
I was going to say, I think that this message around, you know, being being prepared and not being scared is sort of the right message to give to folks, is that, you know, there are things you can do. You can give yourself a good shot at not getting this, not passing it further. You might still get it. And if you do, still, based on the data that we have, the vast, vast majority of people are going to do fine. It's going to be fever, mild cough, you know, staying home. It's going to be your typical flu-like picture. You know, when we talk about these people getting sick, we are really talking about a really small minority of people, most of which are very elderly and people with pre-existing conditions. Now, I worry about the sickle cell patients a little bit, because already one of the major causes of death in sickle cell disease is acute chest syndrome, which, you know, involves lungs getting involved quickly. So for my warriors who are listening out there, I mean, I think it's really important that they stay sort of cognizant of, okay, I'm having symptoms, I have a fever, I need to talk to somebody, I need to talk to a doctor, I need to find some help. I think staying on top of it for them specifically is going to be really important.
Yeah, that's a very important message.
Take good care of yourself, get enough sleep, drink plenty of fluids, try not to get run down, stressed out, get your immune system run down where you'd be at more risk.
All the more important right now. Dr. Amar Zaidi and Dr. Michael Callahan from the Cheat Code Sickle Cell Podcast, thanks for the time, and we will talk to you again if there are other updates we want to make sure to get out there.
Great. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Patrick.
Joining me from New York City is the Executive Director of the New York City Hemophilia Chapter and my friend Jeremy Griffin. Hello, Jeremy. How are you?
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for the call. I really appreciate you inviting us on.
Yeah, well, I'm curious to know a couple of things. For starters, how are you doing today, and how does it feel to be in New York? What's the vibe there today?
Different. I mean, I just flew back from Dallas, and the streets are much more empty today. I'm in an office building that's a WeWork. I would say hardly anyone's here.
Earlier this week, you were in Dallas for a meeting with chapter leadership from around the country. What came out of that meeting, and I'm curious to know how the conversations amongst different chapter leaders were going with regard to coronavirus?
Well, I mean, I can just tell you overall, the chapter leadership meeting was great. It's always wonderful to get chapters together talking, and, you know, there's smart people all across the country working for the bleeding disorders community. You get them in a room, it's like, oh, wow. It was unique this time because we're all living this in real time. You know, lots of sidebar conversations over, are you going to cancel this meeting? Are you not? What's coming up? You know, I think even for some of us, we were talking before, is NHS going to cancel that meeting? Because there was just, you know, things are changing rapidly. I think we'll hear that a lot coming up. And they were,
you know,
but I will tell you, it was nice to hear people talking together about the problems in real time.
I have found it's been compared to post 9/11 by a lot of people I've heard talk about this time. And I'm curious to know from you, does it feel similar to that, or does this feel different in any way as a New Yorker?
It's different. I think I feel like it may feel similar. I wasn't in New York whenever 9/11 happened, so people may feel different about it with that. I was in Dallas the night before, and I remember specifically we were eating barbecue before I flew home, and we were watching a live band, and I said to someone, I was like, this feels like the last night that before the world changes. And today it feels like the world's changed a lot, you know? We were hanging out in Dallas in this area that didn't seem like a, you know, like it was a big deal. And I think the president was speaking about the time we were there, and then flying back to reality, schools all across the nation are canceled. MBAs canceled. Lots of things have changed.
Yeah, I think that's the piece of it to me that feels different. Having been in New York, I'm not there now, but I was there during 9/11. And my feeling was we knew after 9/11 that the world had changed, but I didn't recall a real strong sense of we're going to continue to be attacked and the world's going to keep changing. It was more, what do we do now? I feel like we're still in the change of this thing. I don't feel as though we have our arms around it yet. So I have yet to feel as though it's similar in that regard. I'm waiting for that curve to flatten until I have a sense of, okay, now where do we go from here?
My wife and I were talking about that sense of the 9/11 comparison. And I think what she remembers most is how much uncertainty there was. And there was a lot of fear of a second attack. It's hard to say where we're at with this, but I think that sense of uncertainty is definitely there at this point. People not knowing how long kids are going to be go home, how long this is going to happen. What's the real impact on our community, on our society?
And what are you seeing so far as the real impact on the New York City hemophilia chapter? I saw this morning that you were opening the NASDAQ. So to some degree, things are moving forward, but I imagine there's so much that's changing in real time.
Well, we had an Albany Days event that's supposed to happen this weekend, and that was canceled when the governor came out and said they're not encouraging people to have events over 500. Ours wasn't over 500, but... they're shutting down areas. So we were not going to have that event. There's other events that we're looking at canceling. We have a walk coming up in June. Fingers crossed that won't be canceled. But it's potential changes. Today's was on the books, and we were very happy to go down to the market. But I think what we will see is we know that our community is still going to be in need. I have community members telling me they're in quarantine. I have some that are on the edges of... like, you know, New Rochelle, people are potentially going to be losing jobs. They're going to be even more isolated than they were before. So we're going to have to pivot and maybe look at more online ways we can connect our community. The need is still going to be there. We just need to figure out how we can serve.
Yeah, I agree. It's time to adapt a bit. Well, Jeremy, I appreciate a few minutes today. Stay safe, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Patrick. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Joining me now just after 3 Eastern here on Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th, as if there wasn't enough weird stuff going on, is Emily from Ridgefield, Connecticut. She's a community member with both the New York City Hemophilia Chapter and the New England Hemophilia Association. Good afternoon, Emily. How are you?
Hi, Patrick. I'm fine, thanks.
So tell us, how did you... So you learned that you were exposed to coronavirus, is that right?
I did. I learned this past weekend... that I had been exposed about 48 hours prior.
And how did you come to learn that, and what was the subsequent process like?
Well, so we at that point had no cases in Connecticut, and this was the first case. And I had been in contact with the family of the patient, and it was the family that actually contacted me. And I contacted the local authorities, Department of Public Health, was informed that I needed to immediately start a 14-day quarantine.
And how did they explain the quarantine process to you?
Well, being a moderate risk contact, given the circumstances of my exposure, I needed to self-quarantine, which means I can stay in my own house, but needed to monitor my body temperature twice a day and report that back to the Department of Public Health in my own town. My exposure wasn't in my town. It was in a neighboring town. But I was working directly and continue to work directly with our Department of Public Health to do that. I'm really not supposed to leave the house other than to, well, if I want to, I can run at off times and remotely when nobody's around because I am a runner and that's one of my outlets. It always has been. But other than that, I'm really just not supposed to be out in public.
And to clarify for people too, you have been exposed to the coronavirus, but you do not have symptoms of COVID-19 itself. Is that accurate?
I remain asymptomatic. I am currently at the halfway point of my quarantine, 7 days, and, well, 7 days remaining. Today is day 8, and I am completely asymptomatic.
And how are you feeling otherwise?
You know, quarantine is hard. I'm a very active and, people person, so it's hard to be isolated. And it's also pretty socially isolating to be especially one of the first people in my area in quarantine for an actual exposure, because there's a social stigma to it. So I've really had to kind of step back and had some pretty awkward conversations in the last week.
Really? Like what?
And it's pretty hard.
Like what?
I mean, people just knowing me, you know, feel like, well, oh, should I go get tested? You know, I saw you on Saturday, because, you know, there was about a 48-hour period between when I was exposed and when I found out that the patient was positive or had even been tested. So, you know, people are scared, you know, and sometimes fear supersedes compassion. And this is one of those situations. I think that should be changing as we sort of understand this a little bit better. But right now that's kind of how it is. I sort of, you know, see a little bit of a parallel for our community with the, you know, the HIV exposures back in the 80s and 90s. You know, it's the unknown. It's the fear of the unknown that people just, they're scared of. So
what has been the extent of your, what's been the extent of your social interaction in the last week?
Social media, texts, phone calls. The family actually went public, so my identity was compromised. It was supposed to have been kept secret. I was one of only 5 people to be in contact with the man. But when they went public, you know, a lot of my friends and my contacts, they made the connection. And so it's sort of been either awkward conversations or just having, you know, it's hard to have to lie to people. It's hard to have to, not tell people why you're not, you know, in the world for the past 7 days.
Yeah, it feels like it's causing you to have to test your character in a way, or integrity in a way that is really unpleasant.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually supposed to, you know, be at work this week, obviously, and my immediate bosses know, but other people, you know, are asking questions, and it, you know, it is none of their business, but at the same time, it's hard to say anything other than, yeah, I'm just not there this week.
Have you been in contact with anyone else who's in quarantine anywhere?
I actually don't know anybody else other than the family of the man who are currently in quarantine for an actual exposure. There are plenty of people out there that are self-quarantining, and my town is actually today declared a state of emergency. And so we're doing social distancing, but not actual. I don't know anybody other than the wife of the patient who are in actual quarantine.
That sounds remarkably isolating.
Correct.
So looking ahead to next week, do you have anything planned for yourself, or how are you thinking through, okay, 1 week behind me, 1 week ahead?
You know, I mean, as a healthcare provider myself and a scientist with lots of time to think and read, it's been helpful, but also unhelpful. I do a lot of research on the median time, median incubation time, and have found out that it's 5 days. And so once I make, you know, that mark, that 5-day mark, and then that 11 and a half day mark, my percentage of risk of infection or showing symptoms, it gets lower and lower. And so that's been comforting. You know, there is also, you know, scary stuff you can read out there, but I just have to, you know, inform myself as best I can, and yeah.
Chances are many of us will, if we don't already, find out that we have been in contact with someone who had the coronavirus. We're still getting a handle on just how widespread this is. So is there any advice that you would give to people who might find that someone in their life has the coronavirus, is on quarantine? Is there anything you've learned that people would benefit from hearing?
Well, first of all, it's not a death sentence. It doesn't mean that you're, number one, going to get the virus. And even if you do get the virus, it doesn't mean that you're going to get violently ill from it. You know, we all just need to do the best we can at keeping ourselves healthy, whether we've been exposed or not been exposed. And, you know, almost at this point, imagine you have been exposed, and just practice healthier habits than you usually do. I'm an extremely healthy person, but even when I was planning on taking a trip overseas, I just started kind of bumping up my immune support and just taking care of myself even more than I usually do.
Well, Emily, thank you for sharing your experience. I'm sorry that it is the experience it is. And I'll be wishing you, and I think the listeners will be wishing you, a much smoother week two than week one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily, for sharing. It's helpful to hear about the quarantine experience from not only a fellow community bleeder, but a physician who, as Emily mentioned, was exposed via one of her patients. After we wrapped, she mentioned setting up a stationary bike in her living room because while she could technically bike outside and at a distance, she doesn't want to risk a fall that would further overwhelm the ER, and with someone who's had confirmed exposure, no less. It's important for all of us, like Emily, to be accountable in ways outside of those that are mandated. You also heard Dr. Marzady talk earlier about preparation over panic. This is serious, and an abundance of caution is appropriate, but panic is not. Staying on top of pharmacy orders for meds, scheduling doctor's appointments, that's a great idea. This is not a time to slack off. And if you are experiencing symptoms, which as told by the CDC, the following are symptoms that might appear 2 to 14 days after exposure: fever, cough, shortness of breath. And if you develop emergency warning signs for COVID-19, then you need medical attention immediately. And those signs include difficulty breathing or severe shortness of breath, persistent pain or pressure in the chest, new confusion or inability to arouse, bluish lips or face. And that's not an inclusive list. So if you do have concerns, don't be shy about reaching out to a medical professional. But also be respectful that right now, they're pretty busy. On a practical level, the Hemophilia Federation of America has had to postpone their April symposium. The National Hemophilia Foundation and local chapters and patient orgs around the country are also postponing or canceling events. The World Federation is going to reevaluate the status of their World Congress on March 23rd. So stay in touch with your people and find your organization's websites and social media handles to stay updated. As Emily alluded to, social media and the internet right now are amongst the best ways for us to stay connected. I'm also including links in the program notes to letters from NHF regarding the coronavirus and COVID-19. I know many people are anxious for a whole host of reasons, and I am too. But we got to turn that anxious energy into an energy that serves us better, into preparation, into self-care, and care for our immediate loved ones. And maybe use this lockdown type state that we're in to do some autodidactic learning, or register for that online course that you've been meaning to take, or embrace your nest, spend time learning to cook some new recipes, get a jump on spring cleaning, or binge watch some great content, such as the award-winning Bleeding Disorders comedy web series Stop the Bleeding, available on YouTube or by going to stbhemo.com or searching hashtag stbhemo on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Shout out to all my committed LinkedIn users in the audience. And you are here, after all. Listen to more podcasts. They're a great way to learn, to stay and feel connected to others, and to get exposed to new ideas and new topics. If you need somewhere to start, well, you're here, so I guess you started here, but I'd send you next to Bloodstream Journeys. Each episode features three powerfully told, professionally produced, and recorded stories from people living with hemophilia, sickle cell, and other inherited bleeding disorders. We're also going to be putting out a lot more podcasts than usual the next few weeks, and I expect I'll have a bit more to say about that on Monday's flagship episode, so subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast to have that and every episode delivered directly to you. Tell a friend about us, leave us a review in Apple Pods, and discover all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts to entertain and inform. Bloodstreammedia.com is where you can go for all of that. Patrick James Lynch is the name to search to find me on all the socials. Shout out to Takeda, our presenting sponsor, bleedingdisorders.com, to hear more about them, fellas. Thanks to Jeremy, Emily, Mike, and Amar for joining. Thanks to Philly Greg for the fast turnaround. And Nat and I will be back on Monday with the flagship episode for March, Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month. We ain't gonna let this virus take that away from us. Stay safe out there. Dear God, wash your hands and take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.